Couch Potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Jungle Cruise, The Green Knight, Stillwater, and Jolt. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring special editions of The Dead Zone and The Brotherhood of the Wolf. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Scarlett Johansson is suing Disney over the bonus structure of Black Widow. When a big star, like somebody that you can put on the poster, and it's usually either the actor or the director, when they are used to sell the movie, they work into their contracts that if it meets certain milestones, they get bonuses. And as I understand it, Scarlett Johansson is a little bit cheesed off because of the Disney Premier Access hybrid release that Disney's been doing. She's saying that because of that, it is suppressed the actual theatrical box office, and so she's owed the money that they would have made. And I mean, I don't know the full details. I don't know what's in her contract, but that's the general gist of the story. That essentially, this movie's not going to hit the milestones it would have had it not been released on Disney Plus. There's nothing you can do about a pandemic. There's nothing you can do about the fact that some theaters are still closed or limited with seating and that some people are reticent to go back. She has no control over that, and she's not suing Disney for that. She's suing them for basically lost revenue that's not getting counted in the box office because everything goes to box office. Now, we saw this happen late last year when Warner Brothers announced it would release all of its theatrical movies on HBO Max day and date. It's essentially saying that that raw box office number is going to be lower because people will get HBO Max or Disney Plus and choose to watch it at home. And so Warner Brothers had to make concession for that. And they, I think they ended up having to pay out a lot of their bonuses before the movies were released, regardless of how well it did. This is also not a pile-on story about how Black Widow didn't make money and it bombed. It's just not being counted in the theatrical box office. And that's what Scarlett Johansson is upset about. Partly also because this is like her last movie. I mean, the character got killed in Endgame. Sorry, spoiler alert. That's been out for 2 years. But this is going to be her last movie. I mean, she can always come back. Nobody ever really dies in a comic book movie. But this is her kind of trying to cash in on her last film in the franchise. I mean, she is the reason they were selling this movie. It was her movie. This is one of the issues that studios and talent is going to be facing going forward, is how these hybrid releases work and how to work that in. It's very similar to how when VHS and DVD were first on the market, people had to rewrite contracts to make sure they got money from DVD and VHS releases, not just for the theatrical runs. The next piece of news is actually one that happened last week, right at the end, and it's another one of those day and date issues. Warner Brothers came out and said that in 2022, they are going to release 10 of their films in theaters and on HBO Max day and date, the same as they've done for the full slate in 2021. This is different than exclusive HBO Max releases, and I've seen it been reported as Warner Brothers is producing 10 films for HBO Max exclusively. That's not what's happening. Warner Brothers is taking 10 of its films that are going to be coming out in 2022, next year, and they're going to drop them on HBO Max on the same day they go to theaters. Very similar to how all of their releases are this year. That's different than like The Witches, which came exclusively to HBO Max, or No Sudden Move, the Soderbergh movie I talked about a couple weeks ago. Now, don't get your hopes up. They're probably not going to be releasing tentpoles like The Batman on that schedule. I don't know if it's an exact number of 10. I've seen it said as about 10. So I don't even know if that number's solid. But it's going to be 10 of their releases. And I have a feeling that the releases you're going to see making that move are going to be stuff like Judas and the Black Messiah, an award film that they want a lot of people to see as soon as they can, Or that was that one with Angelina Jolie, Those That Wish Me Dead. Certainly flying much more under the radar than something like Suicide Squad or Dune or The Matrix or any of these huge tentpole releases. What they're doing is they're trying to not just get new subscribers to HBO Max, they're trying to retain subscribers because they know doggone well that when 2021 expires and people know they're not just going to get all their movies from Warner Brothers on HBO Max, you're going to have people leaving the service. So they have to have something in there that delivers the same level of service that they have now, which includes major releases at home. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first release I want to talk about is Army of Thieves, which comes to Netflix later this year.
Ludwig Dieter, we've been watching you, and we want to recruit you. You're familiar with the outbreak in America?
The one turning people into flesh-eating monsters? Yes, I heard something about it.
The world's distracted. This window of opportunity isn't just our only chance, it's yours.
My only chance for what?
A life less ordinary.
This is the story of one of the characters, Ludwig, from Army of the Dead, and he was the guy who was the safecracker. And they're basically giving him his own movie and his own backstory. And Matthias Schweighofer, who is the actor who played the character, is directing the movie, which I think is kind of cool. So he's directing this movie. It's going to be an action movie, a heist movie. And they're trying to build a bit of a franchise outside of it. I find it interesting that Zack Snyder's not directing it, but I'm sure he's involved as a producer because that's part of his movie. But wouldn't it be hilarious if Army of Thieves did better and was a better movie than Army of the Dead? I don't know. This looks like it might be fun. Who knows? We'll see. The next one I want to talk about is Ghostbusters Afterlife, which comes to theaters on November 11th.
What are you doing here in Somerville anyway?
We're completely broke, and our grandfather left us this creepy old farmhouse in the middle of nowhere.
Your father wasn't much of a homemaker. He could hardly keep the power on.
You're saying he left us nothing?
Well, I wouldn't say nothing.
Somehow, the town with no fault lines is shaking on a daily basis.
Something's coming.
This is the latest Ghostbuster movie, and I'm so tired of hearing people complain about what they think the movie's going to be. This film is not trying to be a reboot exactly of Ghostbusters. They tried that 5 years ago to middling success. And that one was plagued with problems because when it was announced they're going to do a Ghostbusters with women, and there are people that are like, well, that's just gimmicky. And then people said, oh, you're a bunch of sexist. And then there was this overachieving attempt to prop up the movie by some people in my field who are like, no, it's really a good movie. It wasn't. It wasn't. It was just mediocre at best. It really wasn't good. It was mishandled. It didn't have a good villain. The reality is we've had one good Ghostbusters movie ever. And that was the first one. Even Ghostbusters 2 in 1989 was substandard. Now, a lot of people are saying, oh, this is just nostalgia. Well, of course it's nostalgia. It's done by Jason Reitman, for crying out loud. But he's sort of mixing nostalgia, because in this one it has that Amblin feel to it, which was not Ghostbusters. Ghostbusters was Saturday Night Live goofiness. But now they're going to sort of like that Amblin 80s It Stranger Things kind of nostalgia. And I'm also getting tired of people complaining about the nostalgia because I'm tired of this nostalgia. I want something original like Raiders of the Lost Ark. I hate to tell you, Raiders of the Lost Ark was nothing but nostalgia. That the costume was an old Charlton Heston costume from an adventure movie. And the entire big blockbuster output of Lucasfilm in the 80s was nothing but nostalgia movies for the serials and, the old World War II films. So, yeah, this dips into nostalgia. There's nothing wrong with nostalgia. I just hope we have a good movie with decent characters. And at least this looks like it's a decent setup. It's not trying to ape Ghostbusters, which the last version did. So I'm looking forward to it. I'm intrigued. Let's just say that. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Green Knight and Jolt.
We're knights of the round table. We dance when we're able. We do routines and corner scenes. The footwork impeccable. We dine well here in Camelot. We have Spamalot.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews and talk about the new ones this week. Let's start off with The Green Knight. Dev Patel stars in this Arthurian legend of Sir Gawain, who must travel to the north of England to fulfill his destiny in battling a supernatural force.
Tell me a tale of yourself, so that I might know thee.
I have none to tell.
Yet? You have none to tell yet?
I fear I'm not meant for greatness.
We all fear. But fear can be a gift.
This is directed by David Lowery, and that's not a big name. He's not like a Spielberg or a Christopher Nolan that has kind of broken through to the mainstream. But people in my field know who he is, and he's known for doing stuff that's a slow burn. And he does the stuff that's very artistic and at times dense and at times, very deliberate. He did the Ghost Story movie with Casey Affleck, where he was a guy in a sheet. And that one was out there, and that one is, a bit of a stretch. He also did more popularly, he did the remake of Pete's Dragon, if you remember that movie from Disney 7 or 8 years ago, which was, I thought, kind of a beautiful little movie. I liked the fact that it went very pragmatic rather than being, the goofy musical that the original Pete's Dragon was. Well, in doing The Green Knight, he has basically taken this legend from English history. And it's an Arthurian legend in the sense that it involves King Arthur and the Round Table, but it's not about the whole group of knights. It's about this one knight, Sir Gawain, played by Dev Patel, who's sort of a lesser knight of the... He's not really one that went into battles with them, but he has a close relationship with King Arthur. And this is a legend from history. That at Christmas, this green knight shows up, who's basically made of wood and trees and sticks and rather than flesh and bone. And he throws down a challenge and says, any of the knights who think they can defeat me can try to hit me. And in a year's time, they must then come search me out in the woods and I will hit them in return in the same way. And so Arthur gives Excalibur to Sir Gawain, and Gawain goes through this, and then after that event, he knows a year from then he has to travel into the north of England to basically face the music. Is he going to get killed by this knight? Is he going to get hurt? He doesn't know what's going to ultimately result in it, and he's on this quest on his own. So it's not a group of knights, and the movie itself is not a standard way of telling stories. It's legend. It is sort of these almost epic poetry standards where they're almost like vignettes, little challenges he meets along the way that build character and show who he is and change him as a person. And there's four or five of them, and each one is sort of a journey of discovery for him. So in that sense, it doesn't follow a standard arc and a standard story path. And that's okay, because that's not what the movie's meant to be. But I'm telling you that just so if you're going to go see this, you're not expecting swashbuckling fights and big battle sequences, because you're not going to get it. This is a cerebral movie, and it's more contemplative and looking at what makes a knight and what knights are supposed to do and the honor and that sort of thing. Even though they may not be actually accurate to what happens in history, it's accurate to what happens in the legends. So it's very, at times, surreal. It's at times dense. It doesn't spoon-feed things to you. But it does deal with story ideas and twists and, so I guess you could call them surprises, that certainly seem like they've been done before, mainly because this is based on legends that are hundreds of years old. And I'm not totally familiar with the legend of Sir Gawain, but from what I have looked up, at least it looks like they're following this pretty closely. Now, this is a gorgeous looking movie. It is probably some of the best cinematography I've seen this year. It's such a fantastic looking film with the color and the depth of it. And I've been one to say, a lot of times watching stuff at home for the right movie, it doesn't really matter. by Dinner with Andre, it doesn't matter whether you see that on a big screen or at home. But this is the kind of movie that really is played into the widescreen, the big screen. He's in the woods and you have all this nature imagery and it's just gorgeous. This is, I wouldn't be surprised if this wins Academy Award for Best Cinematography. So it's a gorgeous movie and it has some really nice elements to it. But like I said, it's not for everybody and it can be challenging at times, but it's totally worth seeing. And for that, I'm going to have to say that The Green Knight kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Jolt. Kate Beckinsale plays a woman who uses electric shocks to settle her impulse control, going on a rampage after her would-be boyfriend is murdered.
I've got this condition. It makes me snap.
Like Tourette's?
Just tiny bit more. Intense.
I've upped the voltage. But there's only so much that a human body can take.
Hello?
This is Detective Vickers.
Sounds like your guy was involved in some pretty sketchy business. I'm gonna find you did this.
This actually came on Amazon last week. It's along the lines of, and I talked about this when I talked about Gunpowder Milkshake. There's been a bunch of movies where they're trying to do the female John Wick. And the Gunpowder Milkshake, I think, got the closest to it. I think they're trying to do that as well with this movie. But it is so poorly done. I mean, it's got the action. And Kate Beckinsale looks good in it. But, I mean, she wears so much makeup that you really almost don't see her real face. And, you know, so if you're one of those people who like the underworld movies because you like watching Kate Beckinsale run around in leather, I mean, sure, this is going to have that attraction to you. And that's okay. I am all for women of power doing things, but her character is not well developed. Her character doesn't have a good sense, really. It is very one-dimensional. And the people she's chasing, while it's kind of fun to watch the action, that's really all it is. There's really no depth to the story. There's no interest to the characters. Every little thing that happens on an excuse for something else. And it just at times is not very smartly written. Plus, I mean, it's wildly predictable and painfully trite. And it also seems at some point it seems to be setting things up for a TV series. I don't know if they want to set up another movie or they want to do this as a series of movies on Amazon or whether they want to make it into a TV series on Amazon. But they certainly set themselves up for this. But at a certain point, making the female John Wick is not about just making a character that kicks butt with an absurd level of silliness. You got to have the story behind it. You got to have the reasons for coming and going. You got to have the dog dying from John Wick. You got to have that emotional connection. And this just doesn't have it. And it was tedious. It's 90 minutes long. It's not even 90 minutes long. When you take out the credits, it's like 80 minutes long. But it just seemed to take forever. So I'm going to have to say I was not impressed with Jolt. I'm not looking forward to any more movies with that, no matter how good Kate Beckinsale looks in tight pants. So I'm going to have to say that Jolt kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Jungle Cruise and Stillwater. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the next review, and this is the big movie of the week. Jungle Cruise is one of those movies that was delayed by the pandemic. It was supposed to come out last year, I believe. I remember covering the trailer for this movie way back in like October of 2019. I mean, it's been almost 2 years, and I mean, that's the kind of promotion they do for a Star Wars movie, not for Jungle Cruise. Now, this is another Disney ride that they're trying to adapt into a major motion picture franchise. It did great with Pirates of the Caribbean. I mean, how many films did they get out of that one? And since then, Disney has tried this before. They tried it with less success on Haunted Mansion, but they're basing it on their rides. And this is based on Jungle Cruise. So let's talk about this movie. Emily Blunt stars as an anthropologist searching for a plant with healing properties, and she rents a boat from Dwayne Johnson to take her down the Amazon River.
Legend has it there is a tree in the Amazon that possesses unparalleled healing powers, and the arrowhead is the key to unlocking it.
Of all the jungle cruises you can take in the Amazon, this one is undoubtedly the cheapest.
We're headed up river to Lagrimas de Cristal. We must secure our travel. Come on.
Hello?
Not a good time.
My brother and I are looking for passage up river.
You're going to beg me to turn back.
Well, I look forward to disappointing you.
Like all the other recent releases from Disney that are going to theaters, it's also available on Disney Plus Premier Access, which means you got to pay an extra $30. You know, by Halloween, this is going to be on the Disney Plus service, but if you want to watch it now, instead of going to theaters, you can do that. And that's an option. If you're going to watch it with a family of four or five, it makes financial sense to buy the movie on Disney Plus because it's cheaper than going to the theaters. But if you want to support your local theater, you can go check it out there as well. The key to this movie, and the key to so many movies, is chemistry, really. And Emily Blunt and Dwayne Johnson actually have really good chemistry to this. That's the thing that holds this movie together. Because one of the things with this film is there's something like six writers on it. And it shows in all the stuff that's kind of crammed into the movie. It's trying to be like multiple versions of the movie. On one hand, it's trying to play off of stuff that you saw in Pirates of the Caribbean. Some of it you're playing off of stuff from like the, even though this wasn't a jungle movie, it was a desert movie, but The Mummy with Brendan Fraser. And then there's also just a certain degree of the jungle adventure that you saw in stuff like Raiders of the Lost Ark. So it's kind of got three different plates spinning at once. And I don't think that those plates ever fall, but it does kind of work to put all those plates in the air. Plus, there's a villain in it, played by Jesse Plemons, who he's great. I love him. The villain's not that great. The struggle with a lot of movies is not having a great villain. And this is a little bit murky, as though even if he is the main villain, because there's another villain in there. But those are just overall structural things that bother me from a story perspective. As a piece of entertainment, it's a lot of fun. It's got the adventure, it's got the action, it's got the humor, it's got the larger-than-life characters. Like I said, Dwayne Johnson and Emily Blunt have a great chemistry together. They really do. I mean, honestly, I could watch a whole series of movies with the two of them. And you know, Emily Blunt, you know, sometimes, you know, for better or for worse, some of her chemistry doesn't always work. Like, I thought her chemistry with Jason Segel in the 4 or 5 year engagement, that was iffy. But boy, she really clicks with Dwayne Johnson, and they do a great series. If this movie survives, it's going to be because of the two of them. But it's still a lot of fun. I've not been on the Jungle Cruise ride, so I don't know. But I can guess because there's an amusement park in Ohio up near Lake Erie called Cedar Point that has a similar, it's like sort of like the going down the Mississippi River instead of through the Amazon. But it does the same jokes where the guy's driving the boat and he's making puns. And so I'm guessing that that's part of the shtick with the Jungle Cruise ride. But I mean, it's a fun little movie. Honestly, I enjoyed it. It's better than some movies. Like, if you remember that movie, The Phantom, which was another jungle adventure movie. I like jungle adventure movies. And it's one of the things I liked about Doolittle last year, even though that got horribly maligned and it was uneven, but I liked the jungle adventure aspect to it. You know, I like those old serials. It felt a bit like that, which is what originally Indiana Jones was playing off of, those serials from the 40s. You know, stuff like Terry and the Pirates, which is a bonkers serial, but it's still a lot of fun to watch. And I thought Jungle Cruise worked. So it certainly is an enjoyable movie, and it's one that I think the family can enjoy, and it's got something in there kind of for everybody. So I'm going to say Jungle Cruise kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Stillwater. Matt Damon stars as a blue-collar worker from Oklahoma who travels to France to investigate a murder for which his daughter is in prison.
The father of the girl, the American student.
Allison came here for college, and that's where she met this girl, Lena. One night, she found Lena dead and called the police. All they cared about was Allison sleeping with some Arab girl.
I loved her.
I know you did.
but everybody thinks that I killed her.
We have exhausted every possible legal action.
Is the lawyer not helping you?
I'm doing it myself.
The story it's based on is the Amanda Knox story. And I'm not going to go through that. There's been so many things written about her and movies that have been made. I think there's a documentary on Netflix about her. And the reason that's important is one of my biggest problems with this movie is there's like turns and twists and reveals and stuff like that through the film that I thought were just really trite. And I was watching it and I said, well, I can give it the benefit of the doubt because if it's based on a true story, then maybe that's something that really happened. It's not. They're just trite plot twists. And so that doesn't work. The other reason you may have heard about it is it got a standing ovation at the Cannes Film Festival. And I know exactly why. Because that's in France. And this movie is an American movie desperately trying to be a French film. Matt Damon's character of a basically a hayseed from the middle of America trying to live and work in France is kind of symbolic of the movie itself being this sort of this American crime drama that's trying to be a French film. And in that sense, it's two different movies. On one hand, it's him dealing with his daughter because he comes across the pond to come deal with her because she's been in jail for like 5 years for this murder, played by Abigail Breslin, who is really given short shrift in this movie. She is not given much to work with. And it really should be her movie, at least her relationship with her dad, but she's really sidelined. And in fact, there's a section of the movie where they don't even mention her for like 20 minutes. And I'm like, aren't you supposed to be there for taking care of your kid? But he goes there and he's dealing with that. And then he wants to go investigate the crime himself. But he ends up getting to know this woman and her daughter in France, and they strike up a friendship, not a romance necessarily at the beginning, but just a friendship, and she helps him out. She helps translate some things for him. And then it becomes him trying to become a father again to this woman's daughter, who's like 9. At that point, it kind of becomes, and I coined this phrase the other day, a French talkie film, where everybody's just in their apartment and they're talking a lot, and it's that character development that way. And if you're into that, that's fine. And here's where it's a conflicting movie, because if you want to see it for the sort of like the crime thriller aspect, it's incomplete and at times doesn't quite work and it doesn't quite fit logic. And then if you want to see it as a character piece, it's there, but it's kind of only half the movie's that. It's trying to do both and it's kind of failing at the same time. Plus, it really kind of, I think, is very reductive of the average Midwesterner. I mean, he's just this guy who kind of talks like this, doesn't have much humor, walks around blue jeans and has a cap on the whole time. And he's just there to take care of a daughter, and my American wit and ingenuity is going to help me kind of figure this out. And that's just kind of this really rote, boring character. I mean, I think Matt Damon does a good job acting in it, but I don't think the movie itself does a good job characterizing him. Don't let the French audience at the Cannes Film Festival, who wanted a French movie and got one, mean that this is a great movie. And it's not even that. It's trying to do both, and it kind of fails at both. There's a lot of problems in this. I could talk for hours about all the problems in this movie, but I'm not going to. I got the rest of the show to do. Anyways, I'm going to say that Stillwater kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Okay. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the Home Cinema Roundup, featuring new releases of The Dead Zone and Brotherhood of the Wolf. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the show, and we finish up the movie reviews. We had 4 of them, and now we got a couple things from the home cinema selection. We actually have 2, and they're vintage titles. They were released, one of them was released in the 80s, the other one was released about 20 years ago, and they have each come out with a collector's edition. Now, they're from Shout Factory, and I love Shout Factory because if you're at all a genre fan, Shout Factory has a whole bunch of vintage titles that they've brought back, either classics from the 60s, 70s, 80s, or, you know, even later, 90s or 2000s. There have, over the years, been video outlets that produce discs that will give you old titles that are either nostalgic or they're classics. and they kind of come all together. Like, I think they've collected all of the John Carpenter movies, and they've collected most of the old Stephen King movies, especially the stuff from Dina De Laurentiis. I mean, obviously The Shining is still owned by Warner Brothers, but we're talking about stuff like Cat's Eye and Silver Bullet and a whole bunch of these movies that the Dead Zone falls into. So I wanted to set that up because now is the time to be talking about the Home Cinema Roundup. The first one is, as I mentioned, a Stephen King title, and that is The Dead Zone. This is directed by David Cronenberg, and it was sort of right in the middle of his career after getting a bit of a push as a horror movie director. Based on the novel by Stephen King, Christopher Walken stars as a man who awakens from a coma with psychic and clairvoyant powers.
If the future were in your hands,
the daughter's screaming. The house is burning.
Would you change it?
Hurry up! It's not too late.
Touch this man's hand, and you are in the grip of the Dead Zone.
I've had another episode.
You want to kill your own son?
I want you out of here.
I'm scared, Dad.
I have had a vision that I am going to be president of the United States someday, and nobody, I mean nobody, gonna stop me.
I remember reading Stephen King in about the mid to late 80s was when I first discovered him, when I was in high school. And I just burned through his bibliography really fast. And you got to realize, when I started reading Stephen King, he'd only been writing novels for about 10 years. I think Carrie came out in 1974, the book, and this was maybe 1984, 85. I think the first one I read was Firestarter. So it was right around the mid-80s. He'd been writing for less than a dozen years, well, at least writing novels. And I remember watching all the, what I would consider the older ones after reading his books. You know, it had Carrie and The Shining, and The Dead Zone was produced in 1983. And at the time, in the 80s, it, I believe, was Stephen King's favorite adaptation. Of course, he took issues with The Shining and some of the things they did with that and all the changes that have been done in his books over the years. But The Dead Zone, I think, was very close to the original book, and there were some changes made. But Cronenberg was extremely effective and respectful to the original source material. And even point out in the special features, I think Brooke Adams says, in I think it's Brooke Adams who says this, she's like, it's not really a horror story. It's a love story, sure. And she's going to look at it that way because she's the romance interest in the movie, but it's more about a guy struggling with his own powers and his own abilities, and it's less of a horror movie. And, you know, I mean, The Shining's about a haunted hotel, and Christine's about a haunted car, Cujo's about a dog that goes rabid. These are all crazy, over-the-top horror movie concepts. The Dead Zone's a much more pragmatic movie, and it's just beautifully made. And over the years, I have grown to love this movie, whereas I kind of dismissed it as a young man, you know, in the late teens, early 20s when I'd seen it. But over the years, I've watched it probably over the last 10 years. I've watched it three or four times. And it's just a gorgeous movie. It's a beautiful film. It's got a great nuanced performance by Christopher Walken. And it's David Cronenberg playing with the fantastic, but not playing in the body horror and the weirdness that he did in stuff like Shivers or Rabid or Videodrome, you know, or, and it's not even like with his next big American release being The Fly, you know, he wasn't doing these over the top things that he was in The Fly. These were much more contained. And the movie is as effective as it ever was. And it holds up. I mean, yeah, there's obviously some elements that you look at and be like, yeah, you know, that TV's from the early 80s or that sort of element. There are no cell phones. But this could be taking place today just as much as it took place in the early 80s or as much as it took place in the mid to late 70s when the book was written. So the print looks fantastic. They did a new scan of it from the original negative. And then on the special features, they've got like a new interview with Brooke Adams and they've got a new audio commentary from the director of photography. And there's a bunch of vintage behind-the-scenes spots that are fun to watch, but they do kind of feel... They're collected from earlier releases on DVD to later releases, but they do kind of fall into just sort of rote categories. But it's the new stuff that I find most interesting. The Dead Zone's a fantastic movie, expertly done, And this new Blu-ray is beautiful as well. So I'm going to have to say The Dead Zone totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Also available this week from Shout Factory, you've got Brotherhood of the Wolf, the collector's edition. This is a French film. Came out about 20 years ago. And in Brotherhood of the Wolf, it's based on real-life events in which the King of France sends a special team to a small region that is experiencing mysterious attacks by a massive beast.
It was at the dawn of the Age of Reason that first appeared the beast upon the county of Gévaudan. It would strike without warning and disappear without a trace. When all hope seemed lost, the king sent two men determined to unravel the mystery.
Now, as the collector's edition, this includes the director's cut of the film, which is about 2.5 hours long. And it does take its time. It's a deliberate movie. As much as it is playing in the realm of horror or marginally science fiction, it still's a period piece. It's a historical drama. It also has interpersonal elements between the leadership of the village and, you know, relationships and romances and, you know, priorities and loyalties to different people. Vincent Cassel and Monica Bellucci are in this movie. And I don't know if they were married at the time. I'm not a huge Vincent Cassel fan. I think he's a little bit, he just comes across as smug in everything he does. But I love Monica Bellucci. So it's nice to see her in one of her earlier pieces. And it's the reason to see this movie is the cinematography and the scenery and the composition of it. Because it was notable as a French film back then. It made a certain degree of crossover success in the U.S. because of the visionary style it was directed in. And obviously being a period piece, you have, you know, the costumes and the scenery, but it also used a lot of slow motion and ramping shots, which were just becoming popular. I mean, this was around the time, just after The Matrix came out, right around the time Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon was doing very innovative stunts and fight sequences. It was heralded at the time as something like Crouching Tiger, where it was a crossover success to the American mainstream. And it has since developed, obviously, a cult following. So Brotherhood of the Wolf is a beautifully done movie and a very well put together. And, I mean, it still feels, I said this about Stillwater, where Stillwater was an American movie trying to be a French film. This is a whole through and through French film. I mean, it's a period piece and it's exciting and it has action and intrigue, but it's told from a French perspective. And I can still appreciate that. Now it's in a 2-disc set. The first disc is the movie itself, the director's cut. The second disc includes, it's like got 40 minutes of deleted scenes. And then it's got like three, I would say almost feature length documentaries. At least two of them run more than an hour about the making of the movie. And those are vintage behind the scenes featurettes. The deleted scenes, I believe, they have the introduction by the director, but the behind the scenes stuff, and that's all in French because, you know, it's all French filmmakers doing it. So you're going to have to either speak French or read subtitles throughout the bonus disc, but it's got hours of material on there, and plus the theatrical trailers for the movie as well. So Brotherhood of the Wolf is absolutely worth checking out, but I'm going to have to say that this and the Blu-ray kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Also available this week include A Quiet Place Part 2, available in vintage titles. We've also got The Bird with the Crystal Plumage, which is, I believe, Dario Argento's directorial debut, and State in Maine from David Mamet. And then finally from TV, you've got American Gods Season 3 and The Herculoids, who made a cameo appearance in Space Jam, the complete series from Hanna-Barbera and Warner Archives. And that's it. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about The Suicide Squad. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.